Well met, friends. I'm Jude Vase.
And I'm Steph Midlock.
Welcome to Atherbeth, a podcast exploring the burns and broken hearts of Tolkien's Legendarium.
Jude, do we have any corrections this episode?
No, we're perfect.
Oh my God, I knew it.
Or more accurately, neither of us checked and nobody called us out on Twitter. So
yeah,
probably, but if a tree falls in the woods and nobody hears it, then did it really make a sound? In this case, no, it did not.
Yeah, guys, you guys are being lazy. Okay, you gotta fact check us. Although I don't know why.
I'll take it either way.
Lazy or kind. Aw, yay! It's amazing. All right, well, that's great then. So we're just gonna get right out of the cul-de-sac. We don't need to be here. We're doing a 3-point turn. We're out.
Yep. We have some business to take care of before we dive into the episode this month.
Yes.
First, we would like to do a special shout out to friend of the show, Richard, who sent us some very lovely swag. He sent me a very comfortable pair of socks with the ring inscription on them.
Yeah, and he sent me a beautiful coin, a Gondor crown from Shire Post Mint. It has a horse boy on it, which I assume is maybe Aragorn on a horse. I don't know. But it's beautiful, and I love it so much, and it was very sweet of him to think of us. So thank you, Richard.
Yeah. Richard is one of the designers, along with our friends Rich and Taylor, of my personal favorite RPG that I've ever played at a con.
Yeah.
Like ever. It's
Me
a
too.
Beautiful game called Descent into Midnight. It's kickstarting on February 15th through March 15th. And we wanted to take a moment to draw your attention to it. If you are a person who plays tabletop RPGs and loves good stories, emotional storytelling, fish people, psychic stuff.
Yeah.
Really anything, any of that kind of stuff. It's a tremendously fantastic game. I cannot say enough good things about it. I have played it at every convention I've been to since they started beta testing it. And I was aware that it existed. And it is consistently the best thing that I play at every con I go to. I absolutely adore it. And yeah. I am so, so excited for them to finally get the Kickstarter up and to put this game in front of more people so I can just shout to the heavens about how good this game is and to make everybody I know buy it. So...
yeah, it's an aquatic-themed role-play game that is that uses the Powered by the Apocalypse system, so it's really easy and fun to play, mm-hmm. And it's beautifully written. They have some amazing artists who are doing artwork for their book, and they play-tested the heck out of it, so it's beautifully done and runs really, really well. So I also have played it multiple times with both Taylor and Richard, and it's been amazing. So I'm going to kickstart it on March 15th. February 15th. I can't wait. And I hope the rest of you maybe go check it out too. You can find them on Twitter. Jude, can you tell them the Twitter?
The Twitter is at DimRPG, DIMRPG. And they're also on the web at descentintomidnight.com.
Yeah, cool. So congrats, guys. Good luck on your Kickstarter. And we're pulling for you.
We'll put all that information in the show notes as well.
Yeah.
And last, a slightly more somber note, I'm sure if you were a follower of this podcast, you probably saw on January 16th, Christopher Tolkien passed away.
Yeah.
Christopher Tolkien, more or less, not even more or less, Christopher Tolkien did create the field of Tolkien studies. His lifelong labor of taking the enormous amount of material that his father left behind, Silmarillion, the unfinished tales, all the things that he wrote and never completed and left multiple drafts and all those things, and publishing them and putting all the various versions together, the histories, all those things he published over his lifetime, made this podcast, all the other podcasts, all the other material in the field of Tolkien studies possible. And it enough cannot be said about how just what an enormous impact he's had on so many people. So we wanted to take a moment to acknowledge his passing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Jude. That was really well said. Well, we've got many paths to tread, so let's begin. Well, Jude, for you and I, we are on the precipice of the month of February. When this comes out, it'll be February of 2020. I can't believe it. Time is going by so fast. Episode 19. Amazing. Here we are. You know what day is coming up pretty soon? The dreaded day of Valentine's Day that everybody hates. It's a terrible day.
Yes, it
right?
is.
Right? It's a terrible day. I mean, it can be a nice day, but it can also just be a terrible day. So we thought about what we could do kind of thematically to like call out Valentine's Day. And we thought, instead of going through and naming all the most wonderful love affairs in Tolkien's Legendarium, which is so boring, nobody wants to hear about that, we decided we were going to count down the top 10 biggest burns in Middle Earth. It's going to be, guys, it's painful. There's a lot of deceit. There's a lot of betrayal.
A lot of broken hearts.
So many broken hearts. But I hope that you'll come with us as we count down from 10 to 1. Some of the biggest burns.
Yep. Tragic loves and busted relationships and all kinds of good stuff. So
yeah.
A very cynical take on the holiday, on the holiday. So I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah. Cool. I'm really excited. I've done a couple of these, and Jude has done, the lion's share of the work. And I'm very excited to learn about some of these because they are weird. And
there's a real weird selection. It sounds like we have a theme, and we kind of do. But maybe you'll just sort of infer it from context more than just listen to what we say.
So. Yeah. And if we missed out on any like really good burns, remember, this is just the list that we kind of thought of off the top of our heads. I'm sure you got to call us out on Twitter. We're at @AthorBeth_cast and let us know all the burns that we missed.
Yep. Coming in at number 10 and maybe the most thematically on point of all of these, we have the sun, who apparently is so hot she can't stop getting herself into trouble.
The S-U-N, not the trouble. S-O-N.
It's not really her fault. The sun in Tolkien's Legendarium is a Maia named Arian, who is described it as a spirit of fire in the Silmarillion.
Whoa.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, girl. Now, is this, and this, they ascribe a female gender to this?
Yeah, she's a female Maia. Well, right. I mean, the Maia have a, the Maia, I mean, that's a whole other thing, but the Maia do have a gender, sort of. Yes. Let's just go with yes for now.
girl, you shine bright like a diamond.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Amazing. So she's a chick. She's up in the sky. She's a spirit of fire. She's super hot.
Yeah. In the Silmarillion, the sun is a vessel that contains the last fruit produced by Lorelin, which is the tree that was poisoned by Ungoliant, the tree that produced the golden light. And it is this flaming hot light. And that's what produces the sun. And the solar component is a male Maia named Tilian, who loves her so fiercely that he follows her through the night sky and on frequent occasions catches up to her and damages his own vehicle, which has the last fruit of Telperion in it. And that's what accounts for the dark marks upon the moon. It's the sun's fire burns his vehicle because he's too dumb to keep his distance, despite knowing that, you know, she's fire and he's stupid.
He is so desperate for the meet cute that he's going to do that fender
light
bender
himself
thing.
On
like,
fire.
Oh, sorry. I bumped your Prius. Oh, no. I guess I'll have to get your number now. Hey, girl.
So that's the cute half of this section.
That is
the
adorable.
Less cute section is later in life, Tolkien was revising his cosmology to move away from a mythic one to a slightly more scientific one.
Okay.
In so much as he wanted to go away from the sort of, he wanted to have it so that the astrology, or sorry, not the astrology, the astronomy was more scientific, so that the planets and the stars and the suns and the sun all sort of worked appropriately.
Oh, cool.
And in that, so in that sense, what he wanted to do is he wanted to have the sun pre-existing Arda, rather than having the sun come up after the elves were born.
Oh, but then the elves awoke in darkness, right? That was the whole thing?
That was his whole beef. Like, that was why he actually never finished this, is exactly that. And I'm actually really thrilled that you identified that.
Yeah, that's the whole thing, like, is that they saw the stars, and that's why they love...
I'm super thrilled that you went straight to that. I'm so proud of you.
I learned something, you guys! Wow! And
that blew out all the levels on the microphone. His beef was that, like, the elves are like the children of the stars, and like
they
that was a
Varda.
Very big piece of their conception was that they awoke in darkness, and the first light they ever saw was the light of the stars.
And that's why they love Varda, because she had the light of Ilúvatar in her face.
Yes. Now, as opposed to, in this system, but he really didn't like that it was like anti-scientific.
Oh. But
like,
I mean, creation myths are not so, well, all right, blah, 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 blah. I get it.
Well, yeah, so he was struggling with it. He was going back and forth on it. So in this later version he was working on, this is from Morgoth's Ring, one of the histories of Middle-earth. And there's a section of it called Myths Transformed, where he's really revising a lot of the cosmogony and cosmology of Middle-earth. He has this version where the sun and the moon all sort of predate Arda, and Arian is still the sun. But in this version, it's a little gross, because version, Morgoth takes a shine to Arian.
A shine. I get it. It's a good sun pun.
Yeah, nice. And he attempts to ravish her.
Oh, man.
And rather than be violated, she gives up her body in a burst of fire and burns him, leaving him gray and ashen.
Oh, all right. Good on you, girl.
Yeah, which is, I mean, there's no part of that that's not sketchy and gross.
It's problematic, yeah.
Yeah, it's problematic. There's very, very little of that in Tolkien's Legendarium, but, you know, it's there.
It's one of them.
Here and there.
So that was like a literal burn, as well as a figurative burn.
Yeah.
Oh, dang.
Yeah, I don't love that one. putting aside the whole like cosmological rewrite thing, I don't love that like the sun, like the two things we know about the sun are that it's on fire and everybody wants to like grab it.
Well, I mean, shiny things, right?
Yeah,
I know.
I don't love it.
I don't know why I'm trying to like justify. I'm sorry. Yeah, no, it's totally barfy and weird. But I mean, that is something you see over like tons of different creation myths IRL in the real world.
I mean,
so it kind of makes sense.
It's less gross than like 99% of the creation myths, like like everything the Greeks ever wrote. It's less gross than everything the Greeks ever wrote.
Oh, I know. Oh, no.
So, and
yeah,
I mean,
ech.
Yeah, it's like a 4.5 on like maybe or like a 5 on the like sketchy myths scale, but still not great.
Yeah. Well, that was pretty good. I thoroughly enjoyed learning about the sun. I think I definitely think it ticks all the boxes for like a good burn.
Yes. number 9.
So what's at number 9 then, Jude?
I'm just going to read the note I have. Because I'm really proud of the notes I took for this.
Wait, can I read
please.
The note that you wrote? Because it's
please
hilarious.
Read my notes for this.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to read. So Jude wrote like a note about like.
No, I'll read the whole thing.
Are you sure?
Yeah, read the whole thing and then we'll talk about it. But
okay. So this is Jude's note.
For this
and
whole
I'm
section.
Reading this.
This is the only notes I made for this whole section.
I'm so annoyed. I wrote pages and he wrote this one thing. The Teleri miss. Sorry, let me start again. The Teleri miss out on the trees because Thingol is horny. Open parentheses. I don't need more notes than this, comma, and I'm proud of that. End parentheses. God damn it, Jude. All right, you have to elaborate.
Section, the title of this section is that kings are dumb. And this section is all about the fact that the Teleri are getting burned by Thingol because they make this long march. They have spent years and years and years marching across Middle-earth. They finally reached Beleriand. They get to the shores of Middle-earth, and what happens? Thingol takes a walk into the woods, meets a Maiar named Melian, and is so damn horned up for Melian that he is going to stand in this glade and stare at her for years.
What?
For years.
Wait, why didn't he go talk to her?
The two of them just stand there staring at each other in stock stillness for years. Meanwhile, his people, he's their leader, their king, his people are like out looking for him, and they refuse to go to Valinor without him. So there's some of his people go, but there is an enormous number of the Teleri that never get to go to Aman, that never see the light of the trees, because they end up hanging out in Beleriand and becoming, you know, the people of Beleriand, because they are waiting for their king, Thingol,
who has been
hanging out, staring at Melian. And when he finally does shake it off, however many years later it is, he finally wakes up. He ends up founding a kingdom with Melian. And those people who were so dedicated and so in love with their king miss out on seeing the light of Aman because their king was too horned up to bother like letting them know where he was at or to like, I don't know, blink or move.
Do you think they were kind of cheesed off about that?
I hope so, but you know what? There's no indication that that's the case.
They're like, we are going to leave a comment card in the comment box because this is unacceptable. I have been waiting for years. Where is that asshole? He's outstanding in his field. Oh, boy.
This is one of the most like bananas things in the Silmarillion to me. It's never made any sense to me, and I've always been super duper confused by it. Like, one, what? Two, who waits? Who just like waits infinitely for this king that is clearly, I mean, so many people died on this trek. There's so many reasons why he like.
No.
They didn't know he was, standing in a field staring at his new lady friend. Like, there are any number of far more logical things that could have happened to their king. Like, Morgoth or orcs or, like,
well, they were looking for him. They were looking for him.
But, like,
yeah.
Any number of things could have happened. Like, sticking around waiting for him to show back up.
Okay.
The least likely.
Wait.
It was an extremely unlikely outcome that he would just turn back up. And yet.
Dude. No, we've all had that drunk friend who's like, I'll be right back. And then never comes back. And you're like, why? What are you doing to me? Now I got to friggin' look for you. Why can't you just stay here? I got to put a leash on you. That's the situation. I can't blame those people for hanging out.
It makes no sense for them to have hung out. But they did because he was their king and they were dedicated to him. And that's why this is, you know, they got burned by Thingol because their dedication to him kept them from seeing the light of Aman. They would have been
high elves
otherwise.
That sucks. That sucks a lot. I'm glad that it worked out with Melian. I feel like in the end, if he hadn't gotten with her, that would have been even more annoying for everybody else. Like, are you freaking me? We waited and now he's not even going to be with her. This is ridiculous.
Yeah. No, that would have been rough. But
so, well, there you go.
Yep.
But I don't know. Sometimes in a lot of these stories, I mean, in all these stories, somebody is getting screwed in some ways. And this just happened to be a lot of somebodies, like the half the Teleri. Poor Teleri.
Yeah, a whole buttload of Teleri. In the next
section,
however.
You know how mad it is? I'll Teleri you later. Uh-huh. I don't know. Shut up.
In this next section, however, nobody's getting screwed.
Oh, dang.
Sing.
Oh, that was a singer. Wow. You guys, you got us. All right. So at coming in at number 8, this is titled Unrequited Love, : The Story of Aragorn and Eowyn. Guys, we had to talk about this. You knew this was coming. All of us know this has got to be one of the most relatable stories to me personally in all of Tolkien's writings, because we've all been that person who liked someone and they didn't like you back and you were sort of a dork about it, right? Like, come on, Jude, you with me on this one?
No, I'm entirely too cool.
No, I'm kidding. Oh no. Now I'm alone standing in my field. All right. So I'm going to give you the super Cliff Notes version of this story because we all know it pretty well. So Aragorn and his bros enter Edoras, right? And he sees Eowyn for the first time. And I have to read this quote. Eowyn, as we know, is the king's niece, but really grew up kind of as his daughter. So Eowyn's a super hot lady that hangs out in Rohan and her hair blows in her face all the time. Don't know why she can't get a clip, but that's fine. That's a story for another day. Hairinpeoplesmouths.com. I don't know if that's a thing. So I have to read this quote because it's ridiculous. So here's the quote. Thus, Aragorn, for the first time in the full light of day, beheld Eowyn, Lady of Rohan, and thought her fair, fair and cold, like a morning of pale spring that has not yet come to womanhood. Barf. And now, sorry, and now she was suddenly aware of him, tall heir of kings, wise with many winters, gray cloaked, hiding a power that yet she felt. Whoa! Okay.
That's a very Tolkien line. That's very much his style. I have questions.
Like, it's beautiful,
though,
but it's so silly.
How old is Eowyn?
That's a really great question. Okay, so we just checked. She was 24. And I think Aragorn was 88.
Yeah,
right?
He's in his 80s. So that's...
Well, there's an age difference there.
If you're an oil baron, that's entirely normal these days.
Yeah, you know, or if you're like a long-lived man that also works. Yeah. But the spring that has not yet come to womanhood is gross. When do you come to womanhood then? I wonder if I've yet come to womanhood.
24 feels, I mean, I don't know.
I think we all have. I think we're all at womanhood. So I don't know. I just love that. I think it's very like,
yeah.
Oh, okay. I mean, here's the thing. Eowyn lives in Edoras. Okay. Stephanie loves Edoras because I like horses and blonde men. But if I lived in Edoras, I wouldn't want to be there. That place probably sucked. Right. So then all of a sudden, this handsome man comes riding in with his two weird buddies or three weird buddies. And I mean, what is she supposed to do? She's going to be in love with them. It's a thing. So there's lots of like stolen glances and there's like instances where maybe it seems like Aragorn is kind of into her, but then it's kind of clear that no, he's really not. There's a point where, so they're like, oh, okay, we got to go to Helm's Deep, right? So let's all drink from this cup and it's going to be good. Here, Eowyn's like, here, you have the cup, Theoden. And now she's like, okay, and now Aragorn, I'm going to pass you the cup. And apparently, when she passed him the cup, their hands touched, and he felt her tremble. And at that point, she says, I know, hail, Aragorn, son of Arathorn, she said. And he said, hail, Lady of Rohan, he answered. His face now was troubled, and he did not smile. And I think it's because he knew at that moment he was like, oh, no, shoot, she's into me. That's not good.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, because he's 80 and he's into more or less betrothed to a woman that's, older than her civilization.
Right. Yeah. The light of the even star is ever on you. Well, later on, Theoden, Aragorn, and Éomer and a bunch of dudes, they go to Helm's Deep. She is left in charge of Edoras. Eowyn leads all the women and children to Dun Harrow for their safety. And after Helm's Deep, Aragorn rides with the Grey Company they go to Isengard and they hang, they do all kinds of fun stuff at Isengard. And then they go to Dun Harrow and they're like, here's how the battle went. And I love this quote. Again, so imagine that you're like a 24-year-old, like young woman stuck in Dun Harrow with a bunch of old ladies and kids. Sounds terrible. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of beefcakes ride up, right?
Yeah, it's Aragorn and all of his what do you call them? All of his...
The Dunedain.
The Dunedain bros, who are like the last blood of Numenor thunder down the road.
Yes. It's a thunder from down under. I'm going to Dunedain on that boy. I'm going to Dunedain on that boy because he's a snack, yo. Woof.
Yeah.
So the quote goes, Lady Eowyn greeted them and was glad of their coming, for no mightier men had she seen than the Dunedain and the fair sons of Elrond, but on Aragorn, most of all, her eyes rested. Yeah, yeah.
That says something, man. If you're staring at, like, road-dirty Aragorn and not the two elves that are in the company, that's...
I know, because they're pretty cute. Well, so then there's like this really real moment where Eowyn's like, oh my gosh, wow, you came all the way to Dunharrow just to see me, just to give me the news. That's amazing. Thanks. And Aragorn's like, well, no. Well, I mean, kind of, but also I have to go and see some Oathbreakers. So, okay, thanks, bye. And I can just imagine Eowyn being like, what the actual fuck? Yeah. Are you kidding me? This is some bullshit, right?
Yeah.
So Eowyn's like, well, can I go with you? And Aragorn's like, no, dude. No, you may not. And she's like, why not? And he's like, because you don't have any reason to go. He says, for you have no errand to the south. And she says this wonderful line that is in the movies and everybody knows it. But yeah. Neither have those other who would go with thee. They go only because they would not be parted from thee, because they love thee. And then she turned and vanished into the night. So she kind of like blurts out her feelings there and then runs away in a very like me in fifth grade moment, which I love. So the next morning he like says bye. They drink from another cup and he's like, bye, Eowyn, but goodbye now. And she like drops to her knees and she's like, please let me go. I beg of you. Let me come with you. And he's like, no, that's okay. That's fine. You got to stay here. But when it is this like really nice part when he rides away, it says like that he didn't look back and only those who knew him well and were near to him saw the pain that he bore. So that's kind of nice. I think it was hard for him to say goodbye in the end because maybe he liked her a little bit, right?
Well, I don't think he was unkind. I think he respected her and yeah. I think he was aware of the situation. I don't think he wanted to cause her any, he clearly didn't want to cause her any harm.
Yeah.
But he was like, also like, you know, I'm not your man.
Right.
I think he's trying to set some boundaries in place. And aww. he regrets the pain that it causes her.
Yeah. That's a good way to think of it. Yeah. I feel bad for Eowyn. I think that like there was no way she was going to get out of that honey trap. He's too cute. Like, oh my God. King of man. Come on. Break me off a piece of that. It was always going to be a heartbreak for her, poor thing.
Yep.
But she's strong and she totally rallied and ended up with a cool dude and like a great legacy. So, yep. All right, girl, you dust yourself off. You're going to be fine.
Yep. Number six.
Number seven.
No. Yeah. Number seven.
Number seven. Daddy Issues, the sad tale of Denethor and Faramir. So we wanted to include a relationship burn that was not necessarily a romantic love. So the obvious choice was, of course, Lord Cranky Pants and his poor second son, Faramir. I want to preface this that I'm going to acknowledge that there's like stuff about Denethor in The Peoples of Middle Earth, which I think is book 12 of the Histories of Middle Earth. But I didn't tell Jude in time that I needed that book. And it's not an ebook. So guess what? I didn't use any of that. All my stuff comes from The Lord of the Rings. Sorry. Blah, da, blue, da, blah. So Denethor, the second son of Ecthelion, the second 26th ruling steward of Gondor, all around cranky poop pants and bad at eating tomatoes. He had two sons, Boromir and Faramir. They were 5 years apart. Boromir, you know, come on, we know these boys pretty well. Boromir was a big, strapping, fighty kid, and Faramir was kind of introspective, bookish kid. And of course, we all know that Boromir was the favorite, and Faramir was not a screw up at all. Faramir was wonderful and amazing, but he was always kind of a screw up in the eyes of his dad, right, Jude?
Well, he was not the. He wasn't what Denethor wanted. Denethor wanted someone to recapture the glory of Gondor, and that was what Boromir was all about. Yeah. And Faramir was a man of the West in a different mold. He was the, he captured the nobility, not the the might of Numenor.
Yeah, absolutely. In the in Appendix A, the Annals of the Kings and Rulers in the Lord of the Rings, there's a great quote. Faramir the Younger was like him in looks, but otherwise in mind. He read the hearts of men as shrewdly as his father, but what he read moved him sooner to pity than to scorn. He was gentle in bearing, a lover of lore and music, and therefore, by many in those days, his courage was judged less than his brother. So that's kind of sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, meet Morb. Well, I mean, I think also Faramir did a couple different things that pissed off Denethor. One thing that's big is that, you know, Faramir studied under Gandalf. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. He was a student. I don't know, like, exactly if he was a student of Gandalf's, but his sort of studious tendencies brought him into Gandalf's circle.
Right.
And they spent a lot of time studying together. Yeah, that's my understanding.
And that pissed off his dad because Denethor didn't really trust Gandalf. Yeah. So I just decided to pick out a couple of things to talk about because I think, again, this was pretty well covered in the Pete Jackson movie. So a lot of people know this story pretty well. But at one point, you know, Faramir, meets up with Frodo and Sam and Gollum and figures out the ring and lets them go. And when he tells his dad this, Denethor is pissed. He is not happy. He's like, well, look at you freaking trying to be so gracious king of old, blot of blue. Well, you're going to be the death of all of us, just like your dear brother, like really laying on the guilt there pretty hot and heavy.
Yeah.
That's when Faramir asks, like, well, cool, do you wish that Boromir and I, like, that our places had been exchanged? And Denethor very, like, shittily is like, yeah, I do. I really wish you were dead. I wish Boromir was back. He says, For Boromir was loyal to me and no wizard's pupil. He would have remembered his father's need and would not have squandered what fortune gave. He would have brought me a mighty gift. Ooh.
Yeah.
That's a good burn. That's a good burn. I mean, later, friggin' Denethor sends poor Faramir back to Osgiliath, even though everyone knows it's a really bad idea. They all keep saying
it's a suicide mission.
Exactly. Yeah. They're saying, like, the Lord drives his son too hard, and now he must do the duty of two for himself and the one that will not return, like, referencing Boromir. Really, Faramir can't do anything right to please his dad. And I just think that kind of sucks. I mean, at the end of, you know, we all know how the raid went. Did not go well. They did not recapture Osgiliath, and Faramir almost lost his life. In the end, it does kind of work out. Denethor does come around and, like, shows the love for his son. Gandalf even says, like, he's going to remember that he loves you before the end. Like, don't worry about it, bro. But it kind of comes a little bit too late at that point.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's kind of a family burn, you know? I think we all got some of that going on. So, meet Morp.
Yeah, that's a weird one. I think Denethor is a depiction of that kind of... Everybody knows someone that's got a parent like that, that has a clear favorite, or that is overbearing or narcissistic or...
Yeah.
Just a bag of shit parent. Mm-hmm. And Denethor is a real good example of that.
Yeah,
I think that's a very powerful sort of... I think the relationship between Boromir and Denethor and Faramir is a powerful one in that story because I think everybody knows somebody, if it's not themselves, they have a friend or somebody that mirrors that relationship.
Yeah. I was looking on Reddit at people's comments, too, because people always ask, like, what is... Denethor hate Faramir, and a lot of people are like, he doesn't hate him. I think a lot of people feel like maybe Denethor blamed Faramir for his wife's death because Faramir and Boromir's mom died like pretty shortly after Faramir was born, and he really loved his wife, so maybe there was something of that hanging on. I mean, who knows really what it was? That's really reading between the lines, but you can imagine. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things you can read into that. But I think for my money, I think it was that Faramir simply was not the kind of man that he wanted.
Yeah.
Children disappoint their parents. And especially when the child surpasses the parent in a lot of ways, Faramir was very much surpassed his father in a lot of qualities. So when Faramir fails to conform to the kind of, you know, the kind of man that he wanted him to be, the way that Boromir didn't. Boromir is everything that Denethor wanted in his children, and Faramir isn't. Yeah. And Faramir is living an exemplar of a certain kind of life that, you know, Denethor doesn't respect. That makes for conflict.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's a bummer. Yeah. Through and through, it's a bummer. But it's also a great message that, like, we can be better than what's laid out in front of us. And Faramir was awesome. And mm-hmm. got it. I mean, I'm trying to remember. Doesn't Tolkien say in one of his letters or something that, like, he is the most akin to Faramir? It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice.
So.
Well, there you go. That brings us to number six.
Number six, and one of our favorite pastimes on this podcast, dunking on Feanor.
Oh my, we have not dunked on Feanor in like forever, like a year. So I am excited to get back to it. Got my basketball shoes on, whatever that is. I'm ready.
Yeah, yeah, we're ready to go. This section is entitled The Burn 13,000 Years in the Making.
This way made me laugh so hard when I saw it.
Back in the First Age, before even the First Age, in the Years of the Trees, when everyone was living in Aman, Feanor had a real weird, weird, creepy thing about Galadriel's hair.
Hey, he should have gone to hairinyourmouth.com.
Hairinyourmouth.com.
Yeah.
I may have to buy that domain now. just redirect it to our website and not have it be weird at all.
Okay.
So it should be pointed out that Galadriel is his niece.
Oh. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot that part. Oh, no.
Yeah, that makes it grosser.
Do you think he wanted her hair, like, for himself? Like, did he want to wear it as a wig, or was he just kind of into it?
Well, so it Ooh. Should be noted that, like, everybody comments on how, like, gorgeous her hair is.
Yeah, that's a thing.
Like, and it's, like, jewel-like, and there's some commentary that, like, In the Unfinished Tales in particular, there's some suggestion that, like, the way that her hair captured the light is, it's sort of suggesting that it inspired Feanor to make the Silmarils.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Kind of. Like, not 100%, but, like, yeah. There's a... Anyway, so it was really, like, he was very taken with her hair. There's a quote, "For Feanor beheld the hair of Galadriel with wonder and delight. He begged three times for a tress, but Galadriel would not give him even one hair. These two kinsfolk, the greatest of the Eldar of Valinor, were unfriends forever."
Ooh.
So he was so worked up about this that it, like, caused a rift between their families. Because
That's
he would
weird.
Not, because she would not give him some of her hair.
That's weird. That's weird. Dude, once you ask the first time and someone says no, you gotta take that and get out. You can't keep harping on it.
Yeah. So that's creepy, and we could dunk on Feanor for that for plenty, but Galadriel takes the ball and runs with it for us, and 13,000 years later, we meet a charming, silver-tongued dwarf named Gimli.
Gimli!
Who, when they meet Galadriel, is just a smitten kitten,
Aww.
And when they are leaving her domain, he says... He's asked what gift he would want, and he says, "There is nothing, Lady Galadriel," said Gimli, bowing low and stammering, "nothing unless it is permitted to ask, nay, to name a single strand of your hair, which surpasses the gold of the earth as the stars surpass the gems of the mine. I do not ask for such a gift, but if you command me to name my desire, but you commanded me to name my desire."
Oh.
Gimli manages to stammer out this desire for a single strand of her hair.
Oh, it's lovely. See, now when you do it like that, it's not creepy.
So, and what he ends up doing with it. So, and guess what happens? And this is this is where Galadriel drops a sick burn on Feanor.
Oh no.
She gives him not one hair, but three.
Oh!
Three hairs.
Because he asked three times.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. And
which you can't, I can't help but interpret as a very good burn on Feanor. Gimli takes these three hairs and sets them in crystal as a, quote, pledge of goodwill between the mountain and the wood until the end of days. My favorite, absolute favorite part of all of this, though, is that Gimli ends up in Aman.
Oh, right. Wait. Uh-oh.
Yeah. Mind you, Feanor is definitely not in Aman. Feanor is in...
the House of Mandos?
Thank you. Feanor is in Mandos because he's a naughty, naughty boy.
Mm.
And most certainly is not getting... stuck back in the body anytime soon. But there's no way that word does not get back to him that there is a dwarf in Aman talking about these three hairs that Galadriel gave him.
There's like, I can just imagine.
No way that doesn't chap his flaming fire named butt that he got that he asked for a tress. Three times, and she gave the dwarf, a dwarf, three
I know.
Hairs.
Oh, buddy. So. You know, I could just see like two people gossiping in the House of Mandos like, oh my God, did you hear that dwarf has that hair and that crystal? Oh my gosh, I can't even believe it. And Feanor's like, I'm so sorry. Excuse me, what? What did you say? Like, that is a beautiful scene.
Yeah, that makes me very happy.
Oh, buddy. You know what, though? It's a great... got to ask nice. And when they say no, walk away. Then it's not weird. He made it weird.
He made it weird.
He makes everything weird, and I'm sick of him.
Yep.
Meet more.
He's the worst.
Well, I like that. So I like that, again, 13,000 years in the making. I'm into that. Yeah. That's really funny.
Galadriel played the long game on that one.
She's like, it's going to come back up. I don't know when, but I'm going to hang out until it does.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Cool.
Number five is a really good one because it is tied into the name of our podcast.
Yeah.
Number five is about Andreth and Agnor. Andreth being one of the principal characters of the Atherbeth.
Ooh, and just really quick, Cliff Notes version, the Atherbeth was a conversation between...
Finrod and Andreth.
Yeah, and they talk about dead stuff.
Talk about death stuff, but there's a way of looking at it as being, they talk about death and reincarnation and the end of the world and a lot of really heavy subjects, but in a lot of ways, what they're really talking about is Agnor.
Agnor, such a hottie. Tell me about Agnor.
Yeah. So they lived during the First Age. Agnor was Finrod and Finrod was Galadriel's brother.
Okay.
And Agnor was their other brother. They had a fourth brother named Angrod, but nobody really cares because he didn't really do anything interesting.
Oh, buddy, he probably had a band or something. You know, he lived in the garage. You leave him alone. He is developing a video game that will never come out.
Meanwhile, Andreth was a wise woman of the House of Beor, which had a very close relationship with the Noldor, and the daughter of its chieftain. And through her house's friendship with the Noldor during the Peace of the Siege of Angband, she became friends with Finrod and Agnor, and Andreth and Agnor fell in love.
Nice.
However.
Oh, what?
It was the custom of the Eldar not to marry during times of war, and the Noldor, unbeknownst to Andreth, this custom was not known to her. And furthermore, she did not know that the Noldor considered the siege a time of war.
Okay.
So even if she had known that, she did not know that the siege was considered a time of war.
So you're telling me, so the siege is going on. How long was the siege?
Thousands of years.
Oh, no. Oh, shoot. So it's not like you can wait it out.
Yeah.
Because she's mortal. Oh, crap salad.
And as such, Agnor never acknowledged his love for her, hoping that she would fall in love with someone else and have a full life.
Oh, wait a minute. So he liked her back?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. But he couldn't.
He never took another wife or had any or had children, obviously. Mm-hmm. And neither did she.
Really?
Yep. But she also never knew that Agnor loved her as she loved him.
Man, so that's like a customs burn. I got burned by my own, by the elf customs. That's some bullshit.
This gravely embittered her towards elves, kind of generally. And it made her perceive them as haughty and distant. And she thought that Agnor had rejected her because she was mortal. And that is a lot of the context for the Atherbeth, is her bitterness towards elven immortality and their view of, she has a skewed perception of what she thinks elves think of human mortality.
Yeah. Oh, there is. We actually did a whole episode on this really excellent piece because it's Jude's favorite and it's our namesake. Mm-hmm. If you want to go into more detail, I think actually we did two episodes. Maybe it was a two-parter.
Yes, we did. Damn. And I'm sure we will go back someday in the future and do more about it because we barely scratched the surface. So, the
poor
saddest
Andrith
part of this
Agnor.
Is that the both of them died when the siege was broken. They both perished when the siege was broken.
Oh, man, that stinks. Oh, that's a really sad one. I feel bad about that one. It feels bad when it's like two people to like each other and it just doesn't work out, you know?
Yep.
That's a bummer.
Even after he returned to Amon, Agnor never took another wife or anything. He remained faithful to Andreth even after her death.
It's nice. And also sad. I don't know. Yep. It's kind of nice. It's, I don't know. I feel like from her point of view, it's like, good. Suck it, you. Because I'm sure she blamed him, right? Like, because she didn't know it was the custom. So she was probably like, what an asshole, you know? But he's like, oh, no. If only I was better at explaining things. Ah.
The very end of the Atherbeth, there's a section where Finrod sort of like breaks it to her what was actually going on there. And
What? Gosh, dang it. Sometimes it's better not to know. Oh, well, great. I can just see a smash cut of Andreth crying in the bathtub now, like we've all done in the past. Fine. That sucked. That was terrible. Why do you tell me these stories, Jude? It makes me sad. Well, that was terrible. Thank you for that.
I live to please.
Yeah. That brings us to number four, which, if you've watched Futurama, you'll like this title. It's Your Music's Bad and You Should Feel Bad, Varda and Melkor. So this one is pretty short because it's really just like a tiny sentence, but I still thought it was kind of funny. So in the Silmarillion, there is a section called the Valaquinta. And there we talk about Varda, who's the super hot queen of the Valar. Okay, she has the starlight in her face and it's great and she's great and super hot. Well, apparently she knew of Melkor from the making of the music from before that time. So she's known that douchebag, you know, Melkor, our main bad guy, for a pretty long time. And it just says simply that she rejected him. The quote goes like this. With Manwë dwells Varda, lady of the stars, who knows all the regions of Ea. Too great is her beauty to be declared in the words of men or elves, for the light of Ilúvatar lives still in her face. In light is her power and her joy. Out of the depths of Ea, she came to the aid of Manwë, for Melkor she knew from before the making of the music and rejected him, and he hated her and feared her more than all others whom Eru made. So I love that she knew how ratchet Melkor was, and she was like, I'm going to come to aid of the aid of your brother and also your rival, and now we're kind of a thing. So meet more. You got burned, Melkor.
Yeah.
I love that he hated her forever. I do kind of understand that.
Morgoth is a little, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a really short one. I just thought it was funny. Because, you know, sometimes hatred is eternal and it burns deep, man. Yeah. I feel you. I feel you, Melkor. I feel you.
It ranks high on the list because it sort of caused, you know, world-shattering drama. So.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah.
Speaking of world-shattering drama, that brings us to number three.
Yeah, my boy Turin.
Oh, no, Turin Turambar.
Oi, Turin. If you follow me on Twitter, you saw me dunking on Turin a little bit this weekend. Turin's just the worst.
He's not... Okay, I'm going to fight you on this. I know he's the worst, but how could he have been any different?
Okay, so I'm... Well, he could have not killed his friends when bad things happened.
I know, but he was doomed from the beginning. He was always going to be an asshole.
He was cursed such that bad things would happen to him. But then his reaction to bad things happening was to then lash out and murder everyone around him and make bad decisions.
Okay, well, he's a Generation Z, so we're not, you know. He's never been told no, Jude. He's never been told no. No. Okay, so really quick, Turin Turambar. This story comes up in the Silmarillion, but then it came out a few years ago, I think, now.
As the Children of Hurin.
Children of Hurin. So this is our main kind of protagonist in that. He's kind of a douchebag.
Yeah, and his father is cursed. And the curse manifests itself as basically everything that can go wrong will go wrong to the Children of Hurin.
Yeah, until they're all dead.
Yeah, so... Turin, at the point where we pick this up, has had a very bad run already. His childhood was a disaster. He's been on the run. And where we pick him up here, I'm not going to try and recap everything because it's just been a shit show.
Yeah.
He had been on the run and he had finally been tracked down by his best friend. And then he killed him.
Yeah.
With his own sword.
Oh,
in the rain because he hadn't been paying close attention because he's a dummy.
Oh, yeah, that's bad.
Yeah. So after this, he meets up with an escaped slave from Nargothrond named Gwyndor. Mm-hmm. And with Gwyndor, he goes back to Nargothrond and calls himself Agarwaen. The son of Umarth, which means bloodstained son of ill fate, because he is apparently extra as fuck.
He's such an edgelord.
He really is. God, he's just trash. While there, an elf maiden named Finduilas falls in love with him. But for the sake of her former beloved, Gwyndor, the dude that he came to Nargothrond with, he avoids her. He does not acknowledge her.
Because his friend likes her.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, they had a relationship. So.
Oh, okay.
Gwyndor, however, is a little salty about this arrangement, and he eventually tells Finduilas who Agarwaen is, and his true name gets out, which is a problem. Because Turin has become a powerful war leader in Nargothrond, and they've become increasingly bold in spreading the influence of the city around, hunting orcs. And he has convinced the king of the city to build a bridge. A river had protected the city. A river had cut the city. Nargothrond is a cave city. It's underground. And a river had run past the entrance, preventing anyone from coming directly towards the city. Mm-hmm. But it also made it hard to move troops in and out. So he talked them into making a bridge.
Okay.
Well, that also makes the city vulnerable. And sure enough, Morgoth gets wind of the fact that Turin's there and sends Glaurung, the dragon, the first dragon in, their shit up.
Uh-oh.
So the city's being sacked, and while attempting to defend the dragon... Turin is captured by the dragon's gaze and gets all hypnotized, wibbly-wobbly. So he's standing there frozen while the city is sacked and the people are being carried off. And Fyndwalas is dragged past him to be a captive of Morgoth, and Glaurung is gloating to him and says, "Well, your mother and sister are being tortured in Dor Loman, and I'm taking Fyndwalas off this way. So what are you gonna do, buddy?" And then snaps him out of it.
Sophie's choice, jeez.
Yeah. He chooses his family and abandons Fyndwalas and bolts down to Dor Loman, where he discovers that nothing of the sort is going on. It is now occupied entirely by Easterlings, and none of his people are left there except for one of his mother's relatives, who is married to the chieftain of the Easterlings there, where he pulls a Turin and murders the chief of the Easterlings, which then gets his mother's relative killed.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, because that's Turin for you.
Sure.
he then turns around and bolts back to try and save Fyndwalas, but it is too late.
Oh, no.
A bunch of woodsmen had attempted to save her, and she had been killed in the attempt in a region called Brethel.
Yeah, that sucks.
Yep. So in Brethel, Turin renames himself yet again and is calling himself Turambar, Master of Fate, because he thinks that there is nothing bad that can happen to him now. So he is the master of his own fate. He thinks he has literally reached rock bottom.
Oh, buddy. You have so far to go.
Yeah, so he's really tempting fate there. He's really pissing into the wind with that one.
Ew.
Yeah.
Why?
So in Brethel, he's visiting Fyndwalas' grave, and he discovers a naked young woman on the grave who has no memory.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. He calls her Niniel, but this is, in fact, his sister, Nienor.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Now, wait a minute. Yeah, he had never met Nienor when she was young because he had already peaced out, right, at that point. Yeah, he got sent away.
Yeah, I don't think they'd ever met her. If they had, she had been like an infant or something like that.
I don't think they ever did. I think maybe his mom was pregnant when she left. Well, we could check that, but so there was like no way they could have known. Yeah. Oh, what a bummer. So, that's a thing. Okay, keep going. Sorry.
They actually fall in love and get married.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, there is a thing where siblings fall in love with each other when they don't. It's like a thing. What's that thing called?
I read that same article.
Anyway, it doesn't matter.
There was an article. I know exactly what you're thinking of. There was a journal article that made the rounds a couple of months ago about family members that don't know each other. There's like a chemical thing that happens.
Yeah.
That without the socialization to prevent it from being misinterpreted, it can be interpreted as like. Like a romantic chemical reaction.
Right. That's very well said. So, unfortunately, he was into his sister.
Yeah.
Uh-oh, that's not good.
If I'm not mistaken, I didn't fact check this in my notes, but if I'm not mistaken, she's actually pregnant when Glaurung shows back up.
The dragon.
And Turin is like, fuck this dragon, and runs off to go kill the dragon. And after a very lengthy fight, he does this cool thing where he like skewers it up from underneath and like stabs it in the belly, which is apparently like the go-to dragon killing move for Tolkien. Okay. But he's like real fucked up by this fight. So he's laying there like half dead, like in and out of consciousness, barely holding on. And Niniel shows up, looking for him. And with his dying breath, Glaurung is like, "Oh, hey, ba-dang, you're Niniel, you're Nienor," and like blows the fog out of her brain.
Oh,
and
no.
it turns out that he's the one that had like fogged her brain up, so she forgot who she was.
Oh, no.
And she suddenly remembers that she is his sister.
Oh, no.
And she then chucks herself off a cliff.
Oh, no, buddy. Yeah, that's not great. Yeah, she goes into the river and yep.
Or something like that. Yeah. Is it off a cliff or into a river? I don't know.
I think you're right. I think it's like off a ravine into a river below. Yeah. I want to say.
So then Glaurung dies. and then Turin wakes up. And he kills a whole bunch of people trying to figure out what happened. He goes back to the town and like won't accept what's going on and is like murdering a bunch of people. And finally is like settles down enough to like accept what's happening. That it was his sister and blah, blah, blah. So he then takes this sword that he's had that is the one that he killed his best friend with. And he has a little conversation with it. And the sword is like, well, fucking kill yourself. And he's like, all right. And he kills himself.
Oh, no. What? Oh, so tragic. That sucks.
Yep. He ends up buried next to Findulas with his sister's name engraved on his headstone, although her body is never found.
Oh, no. Oh, buddy.
This whole story is tragic and bad and gross, and it's great. Like, Shakespeare ain't got shit on Turin Turin Bar, man. You want some, like, just nonstop tragedy. Like, Turin is... Of all the stuff that, like, should be filmed, like, I think almost nothing from the Silmarillion should be filmed because it just wouldn't work. But you could legitimately make, like, a real fucking dark movie out of the Turin Bar stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it's... I mean, like... It has the most cinematic potential. Like, Gondolin, not really. Like, there's not enough... I mean, it would be hard to hang a narrative on Gondolin or, like, the entire Silmarillion. Stuff like that. Like, it's like there's not much of it that you could, like, find a coherent narrative for. But the Turin story, like... Yeah. There's a narrative thread there. You could put together like a narrative arc there. So,
If anybody wants to share their screenplay for the sad story of Turin Turin Bar with us, please do so. Yeah, that would be I mean, I think you're right. It's really sad. He fucks up the whole fucking time. My God, like. Again, I do sort of feel like sometimes one's doom is laid out for one, but we all can make choices, and he made the wrong choices a lot.
Oh, all the time. all the time.
We need to make brave and heroic decisions, not terrible things all the time.
Yeah, the fact that his default reaction to like every situation is to like murder.
Yeah,
is my problem with
you're
Turin.
Right. No, it's bullshit. That's good.
Or drive a naked elf off a cliff.
Yeah.
Even if it didn't kill him.
Yeah.
Or did it? I can't remember.
I don't know.
I know he chased a naked elf around. So.
Well, nice. Let's get back to that one. Hey.
So that was number three. I feel like he Turin earned his spot at number three.
Yeah.
Number two comes in at number two for it scores high on both impact, grossness, and consequence.
Ah.
Number two is Meglin and Idril.
Oh, okay.
Meglin is the son of Eretel, daughter of Fingolfin, and the dark elf Eol. Eretel lived in Gondolin with her brother Turgon until she went a-wandering in Beleriand and ended up running into Eol. We've covered Eol and the deeply sketchy relationship between Eretel and Eol before in the past.
Can you just remind me really quickly what it is? I didn't forget you did.
So it's not entirely clear the degree to which their relationship was consensual.
Okay.
Initially.
Oh, gross. Drafts, oh, this guy.
Yeah. In early drafts, it's like she was not... Like the Tolkien's phrasing is kind of shady there, where it's like she was not, how did he put it? Like she was not unwilling or something like that.
Yeah.
Like
that sucks.
In the early drafts, it seems like he basically like kidnapped her. And in later drafts, it sounds like she is a more willing member. Like she's more willing to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end, no matter how you parse it, like dude is like, definitely like abusive,
okay.
Like clearly abusive in no matter the draft.
That sucks. I'm sorry. Okay. I totally remember now. Thanks. Yuck.
Yeah. So Meglin is Eol and, Eredel's son, and they're living out in Beleriand, and eventually Eredel and Meglin get tired of living with Eol.
Okay.
And they go back to, they escape from him and they go back to Gondolin. Eo follows them. He tries to kill someone. He kills Aerdale. He tries to kill Meglin. He kills Aerdale by accident and then gets thrown off a cliff.
Oh no.
We're going real fast here. Cause this isn't the sketchy gross part. As he's dying, he tells his son, like, you're going to die just like me because you're just as fucked up and dark like me. You've got my darkness in you. And Meglin's like, well, fuck you, maybe.
oh, no.
By all accounts, he starts off okay, though. He founds his own house in the city and becomes its leader and lord.
Okay.
He distinguishes himself at the Battle of Nirneath Arnoriad. The Battle of Unnumbered Tears, which is saying something because that was a shit show. Nobody did well in that battle. however, he opens a mine. He does a bunch of mining and does a bunch of cool stuff for the city. But all of his accomplishments are sullied by the things he can't have.
Oh, no.
Which is namely, from the first moment he enters the city, he is in love with his cousin, Idril.
Oh, no, his cousin?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Elves do not marry kin that close, so he will never be allowed to marry her, which means not only will he not be able to marry the woman that he loves, it also means he will never be king, because Idril will be queen.
Hmm.
So
I don't feel bad for him, though. Did she want to marry him or no?
No.
Okay. I don't like him.
Idril sensed the darkness in Meglin, and his is how they put it.
Okay.
Like, ooh, she can tell there's something sketchy about him.
Yeah.
And his resentment festers.
Ooh, no.
It gets worse when an eagle drops a human into the city named Turar.
Oh. Wait a minute. Do we know Tuor from somewhere?
We haven't really talked about Tuor. No.
Okay. Isn't that Huar's brother? Oh, maybe not. I don't know. Don't listen to me. Never mind. Keep going.
Tuor, we mostly know Tuor because that is Eärendil's father.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. He drops into the city and he and Idril marry.
Okay. Oh.
And Meglin loses his shit.
Oh, no.
Against Turgon's orders, he goes into the mountains to look for mines and is captured by orcs. Meglin does.
Uh-oh.
And is brought before Morgoth. And Morgoth tells him, I will give you Gondolin and I will give you Idril if you help me capture the city.
Oh, shit.
And Meglin agrees.
Oh, wow. Okay. Dang.
And he lets, so when the time comes for the attack, he lets the orcs in and they sack the city and the city is falling. And to make matters worse, he attempts to kill Idril and Tuor's son, Eärendil, believing that it will be the only way that Idril will come to him, as if she does not have her son.
Oh, geez. That dude, no, yeah. No. Wrong.
Yeah. Unsurprisingly, Tuor shows up to protect his son, and Meglin ends up being thrown from the walls of the city just as his father had been before him.
Oh, shit. All right. Oh, dang. Same fate again. And that's what he said. His dad was right, even though he's an asshole. Shoot. God. So he died?
Mm-hmm.
Ew.
But not until after he had caused the downfall of one of the last, like...
Strongholds
against Morgoth.
God damn it. Oh no. The things people do for some sweet tale. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not good though. Man, that guy sucks.
Yep. One of the few times where you have an elf that, like, in full knowledge, willingly betrays his people to Morgoth.
Yeah.
Like, I would struggle to think to name another one that does it.
Yeah.
Like that.
That sucks. The betrayal is like really like tenfold. It's just so painful, you know?
Yeah.
Wow.
So That is
that's a good one. That is a good one, because that's like a whole city got burned. Everybody got burned. Yep. Shoot. Well, good job. That was great. That brings us to number one, who has got to be the bearer of the biggest burns in the bearer. Legendarium. I know. See what I did there? Bearer. So it is the One Ring and its many X's. So we're going to talk a little bit about the One Ring. So listen, the One Ring, the ring, you know, the ring. The ring has a lot of X's. You know it. I know it. There's a lot of history and a lot of drama when it comes to the ring and the various ring bearers who had the unfortune of kind of squiring it around Middle Earth. We're going to give you a list of all the ring bearers, sort of in the order of who touched it. No more touchies. Just stay away from that stupid thing. Now, this is a crazy... there's a lot you can say about all these ring bearers, so we are giving you the uber Cliff Notes version, because otherwise it would be a whole episode. All right, well, so we have to start with the very first person, our friend Sauron. He forged
wearing
the
a
One
mankini.
Ring for- sorry
Sauron, who wears a mankini and swims up to the swim up bar.
That's right. That is a deep cut right there from the early Atherbeth episodes. Yeah, so Sauron, he forged the One Ring for himself, right?
Yep.
He was looking fine at the time. Let's just say that. This is important with the upcoming Amazon Prime show. He was pretty hot back in the day. He called himself Annatar, Lord of Gifts. Hey, baby. Yeah, he's going to make some rings. So, yeah, so he made the ring. And then a little bit later, you know, two kings, Gil-galad and Elendil, they fought him at Mount Doom after a long siege. And he might have killed them, but they got the last laugh because Isildur, son of Elendil, cut the ring off of his big dumb hand. And he not only... lost the war, but he also lost his body and he became a reclusive poopy spirit hanging out in Kirkwood.
Reclusive poopy spirit, okay.
So that is the that's the Super Cliff Notes version of that.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Isildur had it next.
Yep.
He took the ring and ostensibly the finger that it was on.
Ew.
Nobody ever asked what happened to the finger.
and we never will. Thanks, dude. Yeah.
He takes the ring, and I think he probably clocks in. Well, I don't know. Maybe the next one has it for a shorter amount of time. But so he's got the ring, and then he
basically has it for like 2 years.
That's right. He has it for a little while. And then he gets ambushed by some orcs. And gets pincushioned by arrows in the movie. I don't know if that's how it actually goes in the book. I kind of forget.
Yeah, yeah.
He gets killed by orcs and dies.
Yeah, the ring. So the orcs are like kill his sons. Him. They kill all of his dudes, and he's like, "Fuck this shit! I'm gonna go in the Anduin River." So he dives in the river, and then the ring is like, "Oh, fuck you, goodbye," and slips off his dumb finger, which turns him, you know, back to being visible, and the orcs shoot him in the back. I would like to say in the Tudor because that's funnier, but shot him in the back, and he died. He's super dead. So then the ring was like, I'ma go for a swim. Goodbye to you. And laid in the water for a long ass time.
Yeah. Until... And then we have the ring's shortest ring bearer.
Oh, buddy. This is the shortest ring bearer.
He's short.
It's
and
so sad.
It's
so sad. Yeah. So it's our buddy Deagle. So he's like, I just love this. So he was fishing in the Gladden River and he finds this fucking ring and he's like, oh my God, everything's coming up, Deagle. I'm fucking invincible. I'm going to live forever, man. I got this awesome ring. And then, he gets murdered.
Yep. By Smeagol, our buddy Gollum, who chokes his buddy Deagle for it. Takes it under a mountain, hangs out under a mountain for a long time.
Yes.
And then drops it like a chuckle fuck.
hops
out at an inconvenient time, as it is wont to do, because it is an unfaithful bastard.
Yep.
That ring. And gets picked up by the next person.
By our good pal, Bilbo Baggins, who every time I type his name, for some reason, I write Biblo.
Biblo?
Biblo right, well, Baggins.
Now he's going to be Biblo for the rest of this episode.
Good old Biblo Baggins. Sorry, I can't type, and that like just made me laugh so hard today. So Biblo picks it up. No, just kidding. So Bilbo's in the cave. He's lost in the Misty Mountains. He's separated from the dwarves and Gandalf. This is, of course, the Hobbit, which everybody knows pretty well. Mm-hmm. And he stumbles across this ring, and he's like, oh, fuck yeah, I'm gonna put this in my pocket. And he keeps it for a long ass time, 60 years.
As a side note, the Riddles in the Dark chapter where he's like playing that riddle game with Gollum, where Gollum's trying to get the ring, and is one of my favorite parts of The Hobbit. It's really good. I love that chapter.
It's a really interesting thing that ring, because I think like, so I read it again to do this research, and it was like, I don't think Gollum didn't know he had the ring. But Bilbo sort of like gaslights Gollum. Like they're playing this 100%. Dumb game because they're trying to kind of size each other up, because Bilbo's trying to decide if like he can, like what Gollum's deal is. And Gollum's trying to be like, should I eat this guy? Maybe I should. I don't know. He looks yummy. I'm going to talk to him for a while and kind of put him at ease. And they're both kind of size each other up. And then like it's at the end where, you know, Dingus.
Oh yeah, Bilbo totally cheats. Yeah. It's a total rat fuck of a question.
Well, I mean, and the thing is that he didn't actually ask the question to Gollum. He asked it to itself. He's like, wait, what the fuck is this in my, you know, when you're kind of half talking to yourself, he says, what the fuck is in my pocket? And Gollum's like, I don't fucking know what's in your pocket. That's a dumbass question. Why are you asking me that? And then Bilbo gaslights Smeagol and is like, oh, I guess I won the game. You got to take me out of the cave. And Gollum's like, well, fuck you. I got to get this thing first. Hold on. And realizes he can't find the ring. And he starts freaking the fuck out.
Yeah.
Yep.
Anyway,
we'll get into that another time, because it's a great story and it's funny. And I like it. So fast forward 60 years. And then
Bilbo's the only one that doesn't lose it, isn't he?
Yeah. He fucking knows where it is all the time. Sort of. Except when he forgets where he puts it in his pocket. You know.
Yeah. But so, yeah, he's the only one that gives it up. He gets it in the cave and then he hands it off to Frodo.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's the only one that breaks up with the ring.
He's the only one. And it's actually really hard for him. Like right when he's trying to do it, when Gandalf's like, you should probably give up the ring. And he's like, fuck you. No, it's my ring. You're not going to get it. What are you trying to do? And it takes Gandalf being like, bro, sit the fuck down. Leave the fucking ring. I'm done with you. It really scares them, and that's what kind of snaps them out of it. So there's actually one more person who gives up the ring willingly, but we'll talk about him later.
Oh, that's right.
But it passes to our buddy Frodo. I don't know if you guys have heard of him, but he's kind of famous. He's our like number one ring bearer.
Yep.
He and his buddies carried the ring to the Shire and all the way to the cracks of Mount Doom. But the journey was kind of, he sort of lost it and got it back a couple of times. So at one point he loses it because Shelob sort of stung him and everyone thought he was dead. And so Sam took the ring and Sam had it for a little while. And then he got it back after Sam made his like daring rescue attempt and success, I suppose. And then at the very end, he loses it again when our friend Gollum comes back into the story and bites his finger off. At the end, like Frodo's like, oh, actually, I'm standing here in the cracks of Mount Doom. And just like Isildur before him was like, oh, I actually don't want to throw it in, so I'm going to keep it. Sorry. And I mean, it seems like the quest is going to fail. And then our buddy Gollum like is gross and weird and bites his finger off and saves the day.
Yep.
And Gollum eventually is like doing his like end zone dance. He's really excited. He's like, yeah, I got the ring. Fuck you. Boop, boop, boop. And then he trips and falls in the lava. And that's the end of it. And they kind of win the day.
Yeah.
Some honorable mentions of people that do handle the ring. Gandalf does handle the ring twice. He takes it and throws it in the fire. And then at the end, he like picks it back out. He uses tongs, but then he does actually hold it in his hands again. And he was sort of fine. But then when Frodo was like, well, then you take the fucking thing. I don't want it. He's like, I can't have that power. That's not going to work. Right.
Yeah. I always wondered if this section was like poor editing.
Why?
Well, because he makes it like a point that like he shouldn't have it.
Right.
And I always wondered if maybe like he didn't intend for Gandalf to handle it that casually.
Oh, I see.
I don't know. It always seemed contradictory that he was just like, oh, yeah, here's the ring. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. It is kind of weird. Yeah. Because then he makes that big deal of like, don't tempt me. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe like passing the ring and actually like becoming the ring bearer is a little bit different. But there is another person who also sort of flippantly handles the ring.
Well, Tom Bombadil's fucking weird and doesn't count. I don't care. Fuck Tom Bombadil.
No, what are you saying? I love Tom Bombadil. He is so wonderful and weird. We have got to do a Bombadil. What's the Bombadilio? That's what the episode can be called.
I will show up for and be a snarky pain in the ass on a Tom Bombadil episode, but that's all you.
Why? He's so interesting.
Tom Bombadil.
Oh, my God. It's because he's adorable and... whatever. He says my hearties all the time, which I love. Anyway.
Yeah, my beef with Tom Bombadil is that he doesn't make any sense. He's not supposed to make any sense, and everybody needs him to make sense. And consequently, like, people just won't shut up about him.
I just think he's cute. I like him in his yellow boots.
Well, and that's great. If you love Tom Bombadil, I'm not trying to say you shouldn't love Tom Bombadil. My beef is entirely a consequence of the minute you tell people you're like a Tolkien person, like one of the three first questions you get is like, what's up with Tom Bombadil? And it's like, nothing's up with Tom Bombadil. He's Tom Bombadil. That's what he is. He's not supposed to be anything. He's not supposed to make sense. He's one of the mysteries that Tolkien put into Middle Earth to confuse you and make it seem magical. That's what he's there. Well, is he a Valar? No, he's not a Valar. Is he Eru? No, he's not Eru. No, he's Tom Bombadil. He's Tom Bombadil, and he's just supposed to be there and be weird. That's what he's supposed to do.
That's I don't know.
But people are just like, well, but actually, no, actually. No, actually. That's just what he is.
Great.
That's what Tolkien said he was.
Oh,
like,
brother.
Just fuck off.
Well, he was the ring bearer. No, he wasn't really a ring bearer, but he did handle the ring when the hobbits are hanging out with him and Goldberry in his house. And he's like, tell me the story about about Bilbo, or Bilbo, as we like to say. And he's like, show me the ring. And Frodo gives him the ring and he kind of like holds it up to his eye and he tosses it up in the air. And he even puts it on his finger and doesn't disappear. And the hobbits are like, what the fuck? And then he kind of does like a weird magic, like dessert of magic, close up magic thing where he like makes it vanish. And Frodo's like, no, it's my ring. And Tom gives it back to him. Again, he's very flippant with it. And Frodo's kind of annoyed with him because he's like being kind of weird about it. He's like, why doesn't this guy care about this ring? It's a big deal. And at one point, Frodo is like, he's like, I got to check and make sure that this is the same ring that he took from me. And so he puts it on and he does like that invisible, I'm going to move around the room thing. And Tom Bombadil's like, hey, where are you going, buddy? I can still see you, which I think is kind of cool. I don't know what that's about, but I guess it's magic and we're not supposed to know, says Julie.
Yeah, no, the one part of this I like is that Frodo's like, well, clearly this guy can handle this ring. Why are we not leaving this here?
Yeah.
And Gandalf is like, he'd like leave it in a ditch somewhere. Like, the problem with Tom Bombadil is he's an idiot.
Yeah.
And he could not be trusted to fucking like watch this thing.
Oh.
And Frodo's like, yeah, that checks out.
Yeah. That's so true. Oh, man. Well, and of course, our last ring bearer, the last person besides like Frodo and Gollum, like the last new person to touch it is our buddy Samwise Gamgee. So after Shelob attacked Frodo, Sam thought he was dead and he really wrestled with the choice of like, do I take the ring? Do I risk it being found? What do I do? And this little voice in Sam's head tells him that the quest like has to be completed and that he's been chosen just like Bilbo and Frodo were chosen and he's got to finish the quest. So Sam finally at the end kind of makes the choice to take the ring. He removes it from Frodo and he puts it around his neck and it kind of is heavy and gross, but then it gets better as he kind of wears it. He only has it for 2 days in the end, but while he was wearing it, there's this great kind of scene of the ring trying to tempt Sam to like, put it on, man, just put it on. And Sam's like, no, that's okay. And the ring's like, hey, but look, see, you could be like a big sexy hero and you could have a super cool garden. Yeah, you could have all this stuff you want. Just put it on. And he's like, no, I'm all good. Thanks. and it's like really the love, his love for Frodo that kind of helped him hold on, which is really lovely.
Yeah.
He loses it. I mean, he loses it because he saves Frodo in the Tower of Cirith Ungol, and Frodo's like, give me my fucking ring back, you thief. And Sam's like, okay, bro, take it. Jesus, you really hurt my feelings. And Frodo sort of realizes that he's having this creepy vision of Sam as an orc. Like the ring is like making him see all this weird stuff. And the vision passed and he felt really bad about being a jerk to Sam. And he apologized. And Sam's like, it's all good, man. I'll help you. Don't worry about it. We'll figure it out. And the rest is history. There's some finger biting. There's some Gollum taking a swim, and then the ring is no more. So that is your very quick list of all of the times the ring burned people and then ended up getting burned.
Oh,
it all came back around. Oh, bookends. Shit. Well, that was our, okay, so that was our top 10 list of some tragic ass love. What did you guys think? Do you have any things to add? You should tell us.
Yeah, what did we miss? What did you like?
What did you hate? No, don't tell us that. Don't tell us that. No, I don't want to hear that.
We don't care.
Thank you. Thank you. No, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Jude. I thoroughly enjoyed that. I'm going to channel all that rage on Valentine's Day. You know, just like everybody else. It's going to be good.
The road may go ever on and on, but this episode is over.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes, as it helps increase our visibility. You can find us on the web at www.podcast.atherbeth.com. You can find the show on Twitter at @atherbeth_cast. Jude can be found at @AramidicJude, and I can be found at @TheNorthFour. Title music is Lord of the Devil Rings by Pony Music, courtesy of Pond 5. Thanks for listening.